Okay, we'll call the committee to order. Representative Meslow, you have your bill. Representative, you want to move this? Representative Soderstrom will move House File 1583 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. Representative Meslow, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As you know, I don't come to the Commerce Committee unless it's with a bill that's non-controversial and relatively uninteresting and doesn't draw a lot of attention. And that's my attempt today as well, is to try to be pretty boring in front of you today. Actually, as we move forward, I would also ask if Representative Soderstrom or another member of the committee would move the A1 amendment, although it's an abbreviated version of the A1 amendment. Members, if you look at line 11 of the A1 amendment, I would propose that we put a period.
Representative Soderstrom moves the A1 amendment. To the amendment, Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My amendment to the amendment would be to put a period after the number 13 and then delete the balance of line 11 as well as all of lines 12 and 13.
Okay, Representative Soderstrom incorporates that into her amendment. And this is to get the bill in the shape you want to discuss it?
It is.
Okay, all in favor of that amendment, the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill addresses travel clubs that have been operating oftentimes by phone, sometimes in person here in Minnesota. And frankly, those have oftentimes turned out to be scams. There's a little bit of a bait and switch that goes with that. There have been problems that were addressed in a bill that we passed out of the legislature 2 years ago. What this bill does is actually changes the notice provisions, specifically requiring that there's a 10-day period when somebody buys a travel club membership. They've got a 10 business days to cancel that. What this bill primarily does is require those travel clubs to, in the contract, notify the buyers that they have that 10-day right to rescind. The bill is designed to deal with the travel club outfits that come in and do it. It is not for timeshares. That's what the amendment is about. Timeshares are already covered in Minnesota law under Chapter 83. It's not for AAA. This is about the organizations that come in and make the outrageous offers and scam and pull people in. Beyond that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn this over to Brian Dockendorf of the Minnesota Attorney General's Office and let him address some of the issues that he has handled in this regard.
Mr. Dockendorf, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Dockendorf, Assistant Attorney General at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. Representative Meslow is correct. The bill that was passed 2 years ago was a very successful bill. It increased the right to cancel these contracts from 3 days to 10 days, and it has provided consumers with greater rights and greater knowledge when they purchase these contracts. Typically, these are high-pressure sales that come in, and the operators often offer free gifts as part of the package. Representative Meslow also already explained the revisions to the 10-day right to cancel. Primarily what this does is instead of beginning the tolling of the 10 days on the date the contract is signed, there were some problems with people not receiving all the materials they needed under these contracts to make an informed decision. So this bill starts the 10-day after the consumer has all of the information they need to make an informed decision about this contract. The second primary provision of this bill is that the buyer has a right to cancel, and if that buyer has a continuing right to cancel, the travel club operator may not re-solicit that consumer unless they give them notice that this is a resolicitation and that you do have a 10-day right to cancel. And finally, the other primary, basically, clarification of the existing law is that the travel club operator may not offer a gift unless it clearly discloses certain information about that gift, such as the name of the travel operator, estimated value of the gift, and some other requirements. And that's all I have.
Is there anyone that would like to testify against this bill in the public? Seeing none, is a members have questions or comments? That's really unusual. Representative Meslow.
If we've moved past that, I actually was going to clarify my request as to the process for this.
Okay.
And that is that I have confirmed that civil law is not interested in this bill, and I'm therefore asking for a motion to that this matter be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Over on the Senate side, it's sitting on their General Register, where it was carried by former Representative Gerlach, who since has been demoted to the Senate, but has at least gotten it that far, and I'd like to match it.
That is the current motion. It is going to the General Register. Representative Davids?
Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow said that civil law wasn't that interesting. I don't think we are either.
No questions, apparently. Okay, Representative Siderstrom renews her motion that House File 1583 be recommended in the past and be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Chair, you. Members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Meslow. Representative Mahoney. Representative Davids moves that House File 759 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. Representative Mahoney, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 759 is a bill concerned with safety on construction sites, but before we go much farther, I have a delete all 574 that I would ask that Representative Davids move for me.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids moves the A05-0574 amendment. Is that to get it in the shape you want to discuss it?
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members. The delete all amendment.
Let's take a vote on it and then we'll have you explain.
Okay.
All in favor of the 574 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason for the delete all amendment is to get it to match up to the Senate bill. And we needed to put in the language that was worked on with the Department of Labor for issues of enforcement and then to meet the concerns of some other parties. But I have House File 759 has a strong backing of business and labor, and it addresses some critical needs about worker safety and the need to reduce the cost both in lives and in lost construction time and money when accidents occur. Most people see a crane as just something that lifts something up in the air, but it is probably the most dangerous piece of equipment on a construction site. My most vivid memory of a crane is when it came down right next to an oil tank down at Coke Oil, and I was standing on the other side of the tank, and if they had been taking measurements, I would have an Olympic record as I jumped over the 8-foot-high fence without even a single bound, or at a single bound. This bill, I brought three testifiers along with me, and I'd like to turn it over to them. We have Dave Cimarron of the Associated General Contractors, Joe Herzog of Local 4th, of Local 49, I keep going 455, Paul Dorn, the president of Truck Crane Services, Inc., and I'll let them testify and then stand for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Who would like to testify first? Please introduce yourself, Mr. Simrad.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dave Simrad. I'm CEO for Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We are a contractor association representing about 400 building and highway contractors who work in Minnesota's construction industry. The construction industry, as I think most of you know, or many of you know, is by its very nature extremely hazardous work. And among our many initiatives at AGC, worker safety and health is the most important. One of the most hazardous activities during construction operations of any kind is materials handling, and cranes play a vital role in this operation. AGC of Minnesota endorses this bill. We think it's good legislation. We think it will enhance worksite safety. And I'd like to introduce to you Paul Dorn, who is president of Truck Crane Service and who we believe is, in our association, the most knowledgeable individual with regard to crane operations.
Dorn, if you could introduce yourself and go ahead with your
testimony. Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Paul Dorn. I am the president of Truck Crane Service Company of Eagan, Minnesota. I'm also an alternate commissioner on the National Commission for the Certification of Crane Operators, and I'm also an accredited practical examiner for that organization. I'm here to testify as to why we need certification and regulation for crane operators, I've prepared a little outline here to kind of identify why we need this. Cranes are the most dangerous piece of construction equipment in the world. They have the likelihood to cause more damage and take lives than any other piece of equipment. Cranes defy the law of gravity. Construction is primarily the handling of building materials. Cranes handle 90% of the building materials on a typical construction site. Operators have extreme responsibility, comparable to the responsibility of the pilot of an airplane or the captain of a ship. They are totally responsible for the load and all the consequences of the load once it's freely suspended. Frequency of accidents has statistically been higher on smaller cranes than on larger cranes, and this is mainly due to the inexperienced and unqualified operators on the lighter equipment. Truck Crane Service Company is commissioned typically one or two times per year to recover cranes after accidents. What is the cost of not having certification? We had two fatalities in the last 6 months in the state of Minnesota. That's obviously enough. As Dave pointed out earlier, we have the extreme cost of construction associated with accidents and then insurance. We require operators be certified for our company, and we have the largest crane rental company in the five-state area. I have what I call a good analogy, is we compare the certification of a crane operator as to licensing drivers for public streets and highways. That's primarily my testimony, and if others have questions, I'm happy to answer them.
That's it then. Is there anyone else that's planning on testifying?
Mr. Chair, I have one other testifier.
Yeah, why don't we take the last testifier, and then we'll take questions from members.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Joe Herzog. I'm a crane operator for the City of Minneapolis. I'm also a creditor examiner. Wanted to point out the safety aspects of it. About 50% of our crane operators are certified. And without this, the intentions of lackadaisical operators not to get the certification. And what this does is they don't take the time to read the load chart, to read the manual to understand what pick they can do and what picks they cannot do, or how they could better situate the pick they need to do. If there's any questions.
Okay. Questions from members? Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Herzog, I know you're the right one to answer this, or maybe Representative Mahoney. But I noticed in the bill that it's limited to cranes that with a lifting capacity of 5 tons or more. Why is it not applied, the bill applying to all cranes on a construction site? Why is that number chosen?
Representative Mahoney?
Well, as a pipe fitter, I'd just say anything under 5 ton ain't worth worrying about. But actually, Representative, Mr. Chair, and Representative Liebling, 5-ton crane is a pretty small crane, and that is used quite often on a job site or in any situation. That's basically a forklift. And we don't want to make this too widespread. We're trying to actually work on the work within the areas of cranes that we're having our problems with accidents and cause really serious damage. Forklifts. Somebody's not paying attention, certainly they could make some problems, but it's not like something falling out of the sky.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, that sounds fine. I just was responding to the gentleman who was talking about a lot of this happening with the smaller cranes. And, of course, I don't have any expertise to understand what's the larger crane, what's the smaller crane, but I'll certainly take that answer. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
If I could ask Mr. Dorn to maybe add something.
Okay, Mr. Chair, representatives, I can answer that. The certification agency, the National Commission for the Certification of Operators, had designated 17.5 tons as an under as a light crane or a small crane, and over 17.5 as a large crane. So that's why I reference that. So a lot of the accidents do occur in the smaller cranes. Typically, the operators on the larger cranes have more experience, and the majority of them, there's over 100,000 licensed operators currently that meet the CCO certification. So the majority of the larger cranes are typically operated by certified people.
Thank you.
Yeah. Further questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience or the public that would like to testify for or against this bill? None. Representative Davids renews his motion that House File 759 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair?
Chairman, as amended, I'd like to incorporate my motion.
Oh, yeah.
As amended.
That was as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you.
Hey, Representative Atkins, you ready with your bill? Representative Atkins moves the House File 471 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Policy, and Finance because of the last provision. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, we do some housekeeping matters that we have. We've got actually the in your packet you should see, I believe it's the Senate language.
Is that the S-0776-1?
-1, and make an author's amendment to incorporate that, bring it into the shape that we wish to discuss it.
Okay. Representative Atkins moves the S-0776-1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Representative Atkins. Members. What this bill does, and then we do have one amendment that has been agreed to by all sides, but what the bill does is it applies to call centers, and it says that upon request, an employee of a call center just needs to tell the customer where the call center is located, be that in a different state or if it's in a different country. It also states that no financial information shall be sent to a foreign country. We've had, in fairness, I think there was some consternation on the industry's part, and I give credit to both the folks on behalf of the Communication Workers of America who are here with me, as well as the industry. We got together about, it seemed like about 3,000 or 4,000 people yesterday afternoon, and they worked through some of those issues. In fact, I told them that, or meant to tell them that if they could come to a deal on this, that I'd shave my head. And as you can tell, we're close. So I actually asked for the Davids when I went to the barber yesterday, and that's what I got. We are very close. I think the amendment that you will find in your packets, it's the A050567 amendment. And I'd be happy to have representatives of the industry as well as CWA attest to this, but as I understand it, all of that, by the way, I should note it did not meet the 24-hour rule because the first opportunity that we had to get everybody together was yesterday afternoon, and we got, I mean, I was very impressed with the number of folks that we got together to work through these. As I understand it, these are all items that everybody is in agreement about, and I wanted to be up front that we did not meet the 24-hour rule, so if there's an objection from a member of the committee about incorporating, and I would offer this as well, just to bring the bill into the shape that that we'd like to have it discussed.
Representative Atkins, the 24-hour rule kind of went off when we hit deadlines, so...
I still like to...
It's a beautiful rule, isn't it? Representative Atkins will move the A05-0567 amendment. Just to get it in shape, you want to discuss it. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails.
And Mr. Chair, my final comment. It's a bipartisan bill. It's on behalf of myself, Representatives Gunther, Howes, Davids, and Sertich. It makes a great deal of sense. I know, and I think folks will attest to this, that there are still a few little tweaks and some work that we'd like to do on it. And I pledge that I'm happy to do that. I think the members of the industry, and I know the members of the communications workers, are happy to continue to work and make sure that we've got our T's crossed and I's dotted. But I'd like to give an opportunity certain for questions for members of the committee. I think there may be a couple folks that want to take just a few minutes, though, and testify about the bill as well.
Okay, we have... would your testifiers like to testify, or just are you just available for questions?
I think they're primarily here for questions, Your Honor. Okay. But I'll leave it to them if they have a few comments.
Your Honor, I don't get paid enough.
Are you not an honorable fellow?
I try. Then we'll go to the first witness, Victor Dobras.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Victor Dobras, representing Sprint. And we had some significant concerns about the bill in its original form. We met with the author yesterday and with other industry parties and the CWA members. We still have some concerns about some of the language, but Representative Atkins has expressed his willingness to continue to work with us, and with that, we'll not oppose the bill going forward. He's subject to some additional discussions with the author.
Okay. Is there anyone else that would like to testify for or against the bill?
Chair and members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And we, too, are a part of the meeting yesterday and appreciate the movement that was made and we will continue to work with the author as this bill moves forward. Just to give you an idea of the variety of folks that are interested in this bill, folks from the Retail Merchants Association, financial institutions, telecommunications companies, as you've heard, healthcare providers, all types of companies have an interest in this legislation, so we do represent a wide variety of individuals. Let me just run through a couple of specific concerns that we still have with the bill, and maybe first we're wondering how a call center operator would be able to tell if the caller on the other line is from Minnesota. If they don't know if it's a Minnesotan calling and they have to comply with this legislation, then we're just unclear about how they will be able to comply. Second, folks are still have some concerns about the cost that this could impose on their business. If basically it could result in two phone calls to address one customer service inquiry, one to the to a potentially foreign call center, and then if it has to call back at a later date to get the issue resolved, a second call. So that would double the cost of that transaction or that customer service inquiry. Third, there's sort of a perception that that customer service call centers in a foreign country provide less service or an unequal service than a customer service call center in the United States. And the industry representatives that we talk to they say they have the same standards of service whether you know, wherever the call center is located. So there's, this bill might you know, continue a misperception that service delivery will change or will be impacted no matter wherever the call center is located. And then maybe finally, as far as we're aware, there's no other state that has this type of legislation. And we know there's maybe something pending in a variety of states, and we're trying to figure out how those, you know, what those bills look like, and see if there's differences in how we can work and try to iron out some of our remaining differences. But with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Is there a Representative House?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the witness just stated that it would be difficult for the caller to know they were calling Minnesota.
Calling from Minnesota.
Oh, I didn't heard him say it.
Call center, I think, is what he was referring to. Mr. Hesse?
Mr. Chair, Representative House, that's correct. I meant to say that a call center would need to know if the caller, the individual that's seeking a service, is from Minnesota, so that they could comply with this law. Because this would only apply to Minnesotans that are calling a customer service call center or having a call placed to them from a customer call center.
Mr. Chairman, just follow up, Representative Atkins, not that I'd want you to put it in the bill, but maybe you should encourage these places to get caller ID so they know who's calling them.
Some people block their number.
Well, Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, if they block their number, then that's their fault.
Not if the law requires them to identify themselves if it's from Minnesota.
Then they would need to do that verbally rather than... I just think it would be good if they knew the call was coming from Minnesota. They could obviously uphold the law a lot easier if they knew that. But if the customer blocks their own calls or their ID, then it would be up to the customer to make sure they get that information across, and it wouldn't then be the fault of the call center.
I think under the bill, I don't think that's necessarily clear. Representative Atkins, to that point?
I was just going to that point, Mr. Chair, the mechanics of it, I think it's only upon request that the state or nation needs to be disclosed, and if they're concerned about where the call is coming from, I suspect the call center folks could say, where are you calling from? And then the person would say Minnesota or Ohio or whatever. And if they're from Minnesota, then they got to disclose it. My hope, quite frankly, is that for most call centers, this wouldn't even be necessary. If somebody asks you where you're at, you just tell them the truth and say, hey, I'm in India or I'm in Cincinnati or wherever the case may be. But I suspect that that's how it would be handled.
The interesting conversation. Where are you calling from? No, where are you calling from first?
Sounds like the kids in my backyard.
Representative Atkins, I'm just wondering what the requirements are in other states. Do they have similar legislation in the other 49?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, my understanding is that other states are looking at similar legislation right now. And in fact, I think Mr. Hesse may have a better handle on it. I think there's at least three or four that I'm aware of that are looking at a similar provision.
Then I guess I have a follow-up question. How, if I lived in India, how would I even know to ask the question?
Representative Atkins?
Do you know what I'm saying? How would I know that in Minnesota there's a regulation that says when there's not in other states to know to even ask the question?
And Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, whether a call center is located, they'd be working for somebody from. I mean, it could be Joe's. What were we using yesterday? Matt's Widgets or something from Minnesota. But if it was my company and I decided to hire a call center, I'd certainly want them to comply with the law. And I'm a Minnesota company. I've got a call center. Whether they're located in Bloomington, Minnesota, or Nepal, India, I tell them, listen, I want you folks to comply with Minnesota law. And Minnesota law, assuming that this gets passed, would say that if a caller asks where you're located, you got to tell them. That's how they know, is that I'd anticipate that somebody would, if I'm going to tell them to work for me, I'm going to tell them to comply with Minnesota law and tell them what Minnesota law says.
To that point,
Representative Atkins, Nepal and India are two separate countries.
Yeah, I know. I after I said it, Representative Mao, thank you, though. Now everybody in the room knows that, too.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins. I have a couple of questions, I guess. Well, one, going to this issue we've been talking about, what about putting in the bill something about, for example, on line 2, on page 2, line 4, after the word request, we could say something like, and upon identifying their call as originating in Minnesota. In other words, put an onus on the person to say, hey, I'm calling from Minnesota and I want this information. You know, what would there be a problem with that? It seems like it would kind of address some of these concerns. So that would be my first. Maybe you want to sort of see what you think of that suggestion before I go on to my second question.
You want to address that one first?
I believe, Mr. Chair, based on what Mr. Dalbert and Mr. Hesse, as well as the communication workers have spoken of, is that we're happy to continue to work together to try to figure out language that works for everybody. And I've written that down on my draft and would expect that I'd want to bounce that off the folks of the industry and the CWA and to see if that might be a more workable solution.
Yeah. Representative Liebling, you had a follow-up?
Thank you. I'll go on to my second question then, or my actual question. Your amendment struck language on page 2, lines 7 and 8, which gave the caller the right to know the name of the employer of the caller with whom the person is speaking. I'm just wondering, you know, that seemed to me like kind of a reasonable thing to ask them who they work for. And I'm just wondering why the amendment struck that.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, I would defer that question to the folks that we've got representatives here on behalf of the industry and the communication workers. They were comfortable without that language, and therefore I was as well. If they'd like to comment on that,
that was part of the Peace in the Valley amendment, I think. Mr. Hesse, are you addressing that?
I can take a stab at it. Some call centers represent or do business for a variety of firms, and so it's not always the center, if they do business for, you know, two or three different firms, it might not be similar lines of business. It might not always be it might have a difficult time figuring out which particular contract they are receiving, you know, under which they're receiving the call, which business they're receiving the call for, at the onset of the phone call. So it has to do with companies that do a variety of call centers that do business with a variety of different types of businesses.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that explanation. It seems to me then that maybe I could ask all of you to think about some other language for that as well, because it seems to me that there might be some, you know, that's kind of an important thing, and maybe it could be some language that refers to the name of the, well, I don't know, something that gives that general type of information. Doesn't seem like it would be so very hard to do if we could work it out. So I'd just throw that out there, that I'd sure like to see that put back in some form.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, I believe that there's testimony to that issue.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm Joe Lally. I'm a vice president with Delta Dental. We have a call center on the Iron Range in Gilbert. I don't see my friends, Representative Rupervine or Representative Sertich, but 20% of our employees, this is for them, 20% of our employees are up on the Iron Range. We serve a variety of brands, variety of dental brands, some from different parts of the country, and some who prefer that they have a seamless sales and service operation, even though they're part of their sales, or not their sales, part of their service is outsourced within the country. And we, in our discussions yesterday,
the chief purpose of the bill was to let people know where, you know, in the U.S. or outside of the U.S. the call center was, and it just makes it a little more clumsy for our customer service agents to have to go into that level of detail and instead just answer the question that the caller had. So that's part of the reason. Other call centers are independent call centers, not affiliated with a particular company, and serve a bunch of different brands and even a bunch of different products. And as a result, that's part of the reason why to not make that a requirement.
Representative Loeffler, did you have a question, or were you passing?
No, I was passing.
Okay. Representative Yarros?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, did we include the computer or our email system here? Because it's so frustrating not to know where those messages are coming from, and we only have so much time to answer them. And, it would be nice if they would identify themselves. A lot of people do, but... those that should identify themselves, especially those that are selling drugs and other things, hard to tell where they're coming from.
Mr. Chair, Representative Yarros, actually, when I send those, I don't want you to know where I'm sending them from.
Further questions?
You obviously weren't paying any attention.
I didn't hear a thing.
A serious response, though, is Representative Yarros. It's very much a legitimate concern. My fear with doing that with respect to this bill is that we had, like I say, 3,000 people in the room yesterday. I suspect the room wouldn't be large enough if we added that to it, but I do believe it would make good legislation.
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair, and I guess I think Mr. Hess, I was just wondering, on line 13, going where they shall have the right to request an alternative option to contact, I'm just wondering, what would that option be? I mean, it seems like I've personally been through some of this fun stuff myself, and I know that it seems like sometimes the call stations are really trying obfuscation, and you're just sitting and being referred to something that makes it more difficult for you to actually contact them. The company and the call center. So I'm wondering, what would that alternative option be? Would it be as simple as by rerouting the call is sort of nice because right away the customer is immediately rerouted. But what's the alternative option? Mail?
Representative Atkins.
Actually, I believe the question is for Mr. Hesse, thank goodness.
Sorry. Mr. Chair and Representative Saylor, there were some concerns with some technical issues with rerouting international calls. So the group thought that a better alternative, or at least having the option open for providing a phone number for a domestic call center, if available, was a appropriate option. The domestic call center might not have the same hours of service as the international call center, so there might not be the ability also to reroute the call, at the same time. So that we're trying to capture at least the ability to give the person some information so they could make a separate call to a domestic call center if that option exists.
Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I just wanted to just really clarify that it will be a viable option. That whoever the caller is may have to arrange their time schedule a little differently, but yet, are they going to get a live person at the end of this phone call?
Mr. Hess.
Chair, and I think if the amendment does say if the alternative option is available, so the consumer might have a choice to make that if they're is no option available, they have the choice of continuing the call or not continuing the call. So they have the choice at the time to speak with that live person that might not be, that would be in a foreign call center, or to call back a different location, different time to a domestic center.
Yep. Further questions? Seeing none, I think it's ready to go. Is there anyone else that was wanting to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I believe that there's a representative from the communications workers that would like to testify briefly about it as well.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Jim Meyer with Communication Workers of America, Minnesota State Council. I'm also an AT&T employee and a call center employee for 14 years. A couple questions that you guys brought up there that really weren't very unclear answers, and I think I can give you a better answer too. As far as identifying where calls are coming from, say from a foreign call center, today, as you know, our telecommunication systems are pretty sophisticated. What we do in the United States can be done pretty much the same overseas. You basically program your switches, the area codes from Minnesota, so when a call comes in from Minnesota, it can identify either from Minnesota or the area code. And as I'm probably sure of, these call centers are probably being alerted of what federal laws are. There's also state laws that they should be educated on, too, that they need to follow. But basically, the equipment these days can be programmed, so as it is now in the United States, whoever's receiving the call, you can see directly on your phone what area code or what area of the country that these calls are coming from. So the person that is working in a call center overseas would be able to see what area code or however they wish to program it to alert them that this is a call coming from Minnesota so that they, at that point, would be able to identify that they are a Minnesotan. Now, part of this bill that I guess is getting all twisted around that people aren't understanding is the call center employee overseas does not have to identify themselves as an overseas call taker until the consumer asks them whether or not they're in the United States. Basically, what this bill we like to call the consumer right to know, though it has different title on it in the state and on the bill itself. When customers call, all we're asking is that the customer be allowed to ask where the call center is located. We're not asking that the call center employee overseas, when they open up their customer service spiel, that they actually say right off the top of their head that they're from India or they're from Philippines. They're not required to do that. This is basically putting the responsibility on the shoulders of the consumer to request that they where is this person located. If they're located in the United States, there's no issue whatsoever. Should they be located overseas, then the next step the consumer would have is if they're not comfortable with dealing with this overseas call center, that they can request some form to come back to the United States.
Is that, does that take care of your testimony?
Just another thing, as far as level of service goes, I think Mr. Dobros had mentioned that. These people overseas, they may speak English, they may read English, but if you've dealt with them, understanding English is a whole different story there. If you've dealt with anybody with getting your customer service as far as your Dell computer or a calling card or even an AT&T bill, they may be able to read off a screen, they may be able to speak English, they may be able to understand your English or be able to understand what you're saying, but they can't necessarily comprehend them. Sometimes a lot of these calls go down a road of confusion for both the call center employee and the customer. They maybe try to hold them to higher values as they are in the United States, but there's a big language barrier there.
Okay. Questions from members? Seeing none, thank you very much. Representative Atkins.
Chair, just a final comment. In my experience actually dealing with an overseas call center, their English was better than mine. But that said, I believe that the many parts, that's not saying a great deal, I know. Thank you. But there's some very compelling arguments for this bill. I look forward to the opportunity, should we make it out of this committee, to continue to work with communications workers in the industry. I just wanted to thank them both, if I failed to do that at the outset, both sides, for getting together and working through what's been worked through thus far, and just an opportunity to continue to work through the crossing some of the T's and dotting some I's, and hopefully we'll come up with something that works for everybody.
And I'd encourage both sides to continue to work on their differences and see if we can come to, you know, address any further issues that remain in the bill as it works its way through the process. Representative Atkins renews his motion that House File 471 be recommended to pass and re-referred to public safety. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Chair and members, thank you very much.
Representative Clark, you got time before you got to run?
Okay, I certainly have time for this bill. I'm sorry, I've been back and forth between a couple of committees.
All right, Representative Clark moves House File 1914 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, the bill that's before you was brought to me by some individuals who are involved particularly with the organization called Centro Campesino. And one of the individuals working in that organization is in my district and told me about some problems that were going on in another part of the state, and we're going to hear some details on it. And basically, the bill is pretty simple. It says that the existing laws that protect our migrant workers who come to Minnesota each year, and it's between 15,000 and 54,000 workers every year, that the penalties for failing to pay them for the work that they've done would be increased, and that the time that they must be paid would be reduced. I do have one small amendment just to clarify that. And provides that the agreements that they made in terms of the contract that brought them to Minnesota in the first place would be honored, and reduces the number of days that those benefits can be put off. So, Mr. Chairman, without going into a lot of detail on that, I do have one small amendment on page 1, line 23.
Okay.
And this was an agreement working with some of the industry. After the word two and before the word days, please insert business. So it would read, if the earnings should be paid within two business days. And that puts it in line with exactly what passed the Senate.
Okay, Representative Clark moves on line, or page 1, line 23, after the word two, insert the word business. Everybody understand that motion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if we could, I'd like a little testimony from some of the folks to talk about why we need this change.
Please introduce yourself, and then you can begin your testimony.
Buenas tardes. Es un honor para mí estar aquí con las personas que hacen decisiones importantes para los trabajadores y para esta sociedad de Minnesota.
Good afternoon. It is a great honor for me to be here this afternoon with those of you that make important decisions for workers and for communities throughout Minnesota.
Yo soy un trabajador migrante. Soy la tercera generación como trabajador agrícola inmigrante, y estoy muy contento de decir que soy un trabajador agrícola inmigrante porque ahí he mantenido mi familia. Son las raíces de mi padre y mis abuelos.
I'm a migrant worker. I'm a third-generation migrant agricultural worker, and I'm very proud to identify myself as a migrant worker because from that area of work, that line of work, I have maintained, my grandparents maintained their family, as did my parents, and as have I.
Okay, mi nombre es Víctor Contreras. No es que recuerde un poquito mi historia. Mi abuela fue la primera generación en los 30s a trabajar a la agricultura aquí en Estados Unidos.
My name is Victor Contreras. I'd like to briefly tell you a little bit about my background. My grandfather was the first one in my family to work in the fields of the United States in the 1930s.
Mi padre vino en el programa Bracero del 42 al 66 para trabajar en la industria de los alimentos.
My father came during the Bracero program, which ran from 1942 to 1966, to work in agricultural production in the United States.
Entonces yo tengo 17 años trabajando como trabajador migrante en la industria de los alimentos aquí en Minnesota.
I have 17 years being a migrant worker and in the food processing industry here in Minnesota.
Y para que tengan un poquito de ciencia de lo que estoy diciendo, mis hijos crecieron aquí en los campos, en los espárragos y levantando piedras y todo eso.
To give you a little bit of a picture of what I'm talking about, my children were raised here in the fields, in the asparagus fields and the vegetable fields of Minnesota.
Y nunca he perdido la conexión con otros lugares ni unos trabajadores migrantes, y al entender las historias estamos preocupados lo que está pasando con los trabajadores migrantes.
So I've never lost the connection with all the different places that migrant workers come in Minnesota, and for that reason we are very worried about some of the issues that migrant workers face.
Estamos hablando de 35 trabajadores migrantes que vienen con familias enteras manejando 1,350 millas.
We're talking about approximately 35,000 migrant agricultural worker families that come approximately 1,300 miles with their families to work in agricultural production.
Para poner su parte de la economía de Minnesota.
To contribute to the economy of Minnesota.
Para contribuir al círculo de esta sociedad donde cada quien pone una parte importante.
To contribute to the cycle of the society where each person puts an important part.
Sí, los trabajadores migrantes tienen y hacen trabajo a la industria, a los campos.
If the migrant agriculture workers come and do an important piece of the work in the fields.
Pero ese trabajo que hacemos nosotros.
That work that we do.
Da más trabajo a terceras y cuartas personas.
It also provides employment opportunities for third and three and four other people.
y estas corporaciones distribuyen sus productos a todas las partes del mundo.
These corporations sell their product throughout the world.
Lo que me da tristeza a mí es que
what makes me sad is that
las temporadas de cada año
each season, each agricultural season,
la gente viene con una esperanza de ahorrar un poco de dinero.
People come with hopes to save a little bit of money after the working season.
Y resulta que a veces
and it results that sometimes
los trabajadores vienen dispuestos, son fieles.
Workers that are here available to work, that are faithful to the work, that come year after year.
Pero a veces las compañías paran sus producciones.
But sometimes the companies stop the production.
Y el pago sale corto.
And the payment is very short.
De esa manera queremos ver cómo las corporaciones están respondiendo a estos trabajadores.
In this way, we would like to see how the corporations would respond in these situations to the workers that they've recruited and brought to the state.
Recuerdo que el 96 vine yo a Minnesota.
I remember in 1996 when I came to Minnesota.
Con unas esperanzas de ahorrar dinero para la familia.
With my hopes to save money for my family, make money for my family.
Y tengo dos niños, venían muy contentos.
I had two children. We all came very happily here to Minnesota.
Pues la industria siempre compra mucha maquinaria.
Each year also the industry has bought an increased number of machines and mechanized, the industry's mechanized.
Y ese año cuando hicimos mucho dinero, trabajamos tres días, cuatro no, cuatro sí, tres no.
This year we didn't make that much money because the industry provided maybe 3 days one week, 4 days another week, 3 days another week, depending on what they needed in terms of workers.
Se acabó la temporada.
The season ended.
Y casi nomás llevamos el dinero para la gasolina para regresar.
We basically only had enough money to pay for our gas to return.
Y asegurando que llevamos suficiente aceite para los motores de nuestras trocas, son muebles viejitos.
And enough money for the oil that we need for our trucks. They're older trucks, older cars to get us across the country.
Y yo estaba pensando que no llevaba dinero, pero mis hijos también estaban pensando, emocionalmente estaban afectando y yo no podía mirar eso.
I was worried about the fact that we didn't have much money, but I also saw the emotional reaction and the stress in my children's face, and that's the part that couldn't stand. We came to work, we worked very hard, and we could not save money.
Y allá por Kansas, Missouri,
and there in Kansas, Missouri,
yo pude notar que mis hijos iban un poco tristes con la cabeza agachada.
I could see that my children were in the back seat sad with their kind of heads down.
Yo le dije, pues, ¿tú qué traen? ¿Qué?
And
¿qué
I asked them, why are you so quiet? Why are you so serious? Why is your face so sad?
La niña me dijo, no, pues que no vamos a tener dinero para las vacaciones, para las Christmas days, todo eso.
And she, my daughter answered to me, you know what, I know that we're not going to have enough money for vacations, for any holidays, for Christmas.
Entonces lo que yo le dije, mija, no te preocupes.
But I said to her, my daughter, don't worry.
Es importante el dinero,
the money is very important,
estar juntos.
But the most important thing is that we're together.
Y es lo que yo, el mensaje que traigo aquí, que
and juntos, that's the message that I bring here, that together, the legislature,
podemos trabajar.
We can work together
en sensibilidad,
with sensibility and common sense,
solidaridad,
also in solidarity,
para proteger
to protect
los trabajadores,
workers,
y trabajar en los valores de los minnesotanos,
and work together with the values of Minnesotans.
Y ese es uno de mis testimonios. Muchas gracias.
That's one of my testimonies. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Bruce Nestor. I'm a private practice attorney here in Minneapolis, as well as a part-time staff attorney with Central Campesino out of Owatonna. I handle a number of wage payment cases that would be affected by the pending legislation, as well as work with a group, Centro de Derechos de Laborales, here in Minneapolis, and various legal aid agencies throughout the state that handle wage payment claims also. Just to speak briefly to the legislation, I think the first part of it is really about creating an incentive for employers to comply with existing law. The existing law only provides a penalty of up to 15 days of wages if you fail to pay wages that are due upon termination of employment. And essentially for employers who want to decide not to pay wages that are due, that can create an incentive where if they're only caught about 50% of the time or less, meaning that someone actually brings a legal action or forces them to pay, they're actually going to be making money by failing to pay wages. Say if they fail to pay the last 2 weeks of wages or about 15 days,
the penalty is only equal to the amount of 15 days wages, and therefore if they fail to pay and only get caught about half the time, they're still going to make money. And so the point is to put an incentive on the employer to comply and to pay the wages that are due, because it's going to be more costly to them to fail to pay those wages. And this is really making sure that the wages are paid without trying to create some sort of government bureaucracy to force the payment, or without forcing workers to have to resort to the court system and burden the court system to get payment, but to increase the incentive on the employers to comply themselves. The second part of the law, making it a gross misdemeanor and shortening the time from 60 days to 30 days for failure to pay benefits or supplements, I think most directly affects a provision in existing Minnesota law of Section 181.73, which requires employers that bring workers to the state, migrant workers to the state, to provide health insurance to those workers while they're here working in the state. And the point of that law, as I understand it, is to make sure that employers that recruit migrant workers to provide temporary labor don't bring workers here who might then get injured or put a burden upon uninsured care through hospitals or upon Minnesota Care or some other health insurance program, but rather that if you're going to bring a worker here just to work from May to September, that you have to provide health insurance for those workers, and this would increase the penalties if you fail to comply with that existing law. And then the third section of the law, which increases fines, speaks to, again, to existing law, which requires that an employer who is recruiting migrant workers to come here and work disclose in writing in both English and Spanish the nature of the work to be performed, the amount of the work to be performed, and to guarantee that at least 70 hours of work will be available in any two-week pay period. And again, the point of that existing law is to ensure that employers don't over-recruit, that they don't bring several hundred workers here when there are only a dozen positions, thereby having a whole bunch of people end up in the community without work and all the burdens that that can create, not just on the workers, but on the community itself. I believe the penalties were set at $250 back in the early 80s when that law was first passed, and that by providing for a $500 penalty for a violation of those agreements, again, would increase the incentive for employers to comply with existing law and benefit not just workers, but also the communities where these workers are being hosted while they're here each summer during the working season.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you can see, we're modifying a lot of existing law, just increasing penalties because of some situations that have actually happened. So if any questions, we'd like to answer.
Is there, first let's just see if there's anyone else that would like to testify for or against this bill. None. Sir?
Just want to add another information. We're talking about the workers. The workers we're talking about, they are citizens and residents of the United States who can recruit the corporations.
Thank you very much. Questions from members? Seeing none. Representative Clark renews her motion that House File 1914 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you very much. And we have the minutes in front of us for the March 31st, April 5th, 6th, and 7th. Representative Hamilton moves those minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Members, that's our last scheduled meeting. We may or may not have further meetings this session. At this point, I don't know. I'd like to thank our pages, Dan and Frank. Also, Brad Beers, our committee administrator, Robert Freeman, our committee legislative assistant, Phil Raines, the Republican researcher, and Brian Dower, the Democrat researcher and House research. Ms. Long and Mr. Pender, thank you very much for all your long hours that you put in, and to the members of the committee, thank you very much. I appreciate all your input on the bills we've heard, and we are adjourned.